stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm doing the last of the interviews I did at the 2013 Miami Book Fair. This interview is with writer, journalist, Kevin Perino, whose current book is Lincoln, The Making of a Statesman and the Dawn of American Power. It's a very interesting take on Abraham Lincoln's life and the way he conducted his foreign policy. And Kevin's personal story is interesting. So hang on. Here come the show. Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about finding, discovering, and recovering pieces of yourself which you may have been forced by the conditions of your early life to leave behind. This can be anything from a talent. Maybe you wanted to draw or sing or dance. Maybe you fell in love with music early in your life, or color, or design, or acting. Maybe you wanted to have people look at you. Maybe you just fell in love with the idea of making different voices and being different people. And maybe you were teased, criticized, yelled at, punished, even, for the expression of this interest, of this attachment, this passion. Maybe it was passion itself that came in for the criticism. You're too expressive, you're too emotional, you're too high-strung. Maybe it was a quality of yours. Maybe you had a funny laugh, or you guzzled your food, or you did something that went down badly with your family of origin. Maybe it was just you. Maybe you got the idea from your family of origin, or from your school, or from playmates, friends, people who were acquaintances but not friends, that there was something wrong with you. We hear so much these days about bullying based on what people look like, sound like, talk like, and the terrible beating, really, emotional at least, that some kids take for being who they are. And when that happens to you, what finally occurs is that it is likely, anyway, that you will arrive at adulthood thinking that there is something wrong with you, reluctant to express yourself, reluctant to risk. Maybe you took a risk in elementary school. You got up and sang a song and somebody made fun of you. Maybe you expressed an interest in a particular activity and you were told that little girls or little boys didn't do that. And so you wound up thinking about yourself as someone flawed, someone inadequate. And you take that feeling with you into your life. So if that happens, then what you left behind was your feeling of adequacy, your feeling of competence, your feeling that you are fine, that you can take the risks that life demands, that you can go for, reach out for, attempt to get the things that you want. How many of us don't do that? How many of us are stymied, stuck, caught, embarrassed? How many of us spend time thinking, if only I could do such and such, or way later in life, if only I had done such and such? So, as a psychotherapist, of course, this is what I deal with every day. People who want to do something which they don't seem to be able to make themselves do, or want to stop doing something that they can't make themselves stop doing. And inevitably, the source of this is something they learned in their childhood, either in their family of origin or their school. And schools can come in for a lot of the responsibility for this. Inadequate teachers, bullying students. The culture can do it. If you are raised in a rather repressive culture, then it's unlikely that you're going to develop whatever your natural spontaneity might have been. If your sexual preference is frowned on by the culture, the family, the religion that you were born into, you might grow up feeling that there was something basically wrong with you. And that, of course, will transfer across the board to everything in your life. So, families, schools, cultures, religions are quite capable of undermining what is natural to us. And again, as a therapist, it's my work to help people figure out what was left behind and how it got left behind. That isn't necessary to know. I'm fond of saying that insight doesn't change behavior. But our conscious mind seems to like to know the whys of things. That's not W-I-S-E, that's W-H-Y apostrophe S, the why of things. And so we do look for, how did this happen to you? And usually it's not that hard to find. Although, as I said, it's not necessary to find it to fix it. If you are somebody who feels that you can't do what you want to do in life, then it's quite clear that this happened to you in childhood. So the job of therapy, of course, is to first help people figure out, well, actually, it's first to assure them that this lesson that they learned in childhood is is almost certainly inaccurate, and that they can recover the things that have been left behind, the talents, the abilities, the skills, the natural tendencies, the self-esteem, and then to do the work of doing that. It's not complicated, but it is work, and it's usually requires challenging a lifetime of accepting this version of yourself, however inaccurate it is. So the Lynn Show is about making this point, about saying that maybe you are aware of something that you left behind. Maybe you know that you think of yourself as incompetent, and that you always wanted to feel competent, able, talented, that you wanted to be able to take the risk of pursuing something that attracted you, for which you had a passion, but you weren't ever able to because of this feeling of inability. So, this is what the message I send. It is possible to recover it, and therapy is one of the ways that people can recover these things. If you want to talk to me about therapy and the possibility of altering your life so that it is a happier place for you to live, you can get in touch with me by going up to my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com. There's a button for email me or contact me, and you click it and you contact me, and I will email you back or call you, and we can talk about what psychotherapy is supposed to do. If you want to talk about coming into therapy with me, that would be fine, but it isn't required. I do all my work on the phone these days, so it doesn't matter where you live. You can get all other kinds of stuff on the website, like you can on everybody's website. There's a copy of my book, and I'm reading the first chapter of it. There's an article called Psychotherapy on the Go about the psychotherapy on the phone that I do. There's all kinds of stuff up there. You can find out anything you might want to know about me. You can get me to come and talk to your group or organization about this issue and why change is so hard. And you can listen to all of my shows. They're all up there, podcasts of all of the shows, including the one I'm doing today. And in my shows, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because when you listen to someone who has chosen to dedicate their life in some way to an art, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. We make it so difficult for people to give their life to an art in this culture that the people who do it are in sync with it. They're compatible with it. It is, as therapists say, congruent for them. And so it is my hope that when you listen, you are inspired to ask yourself if this is true for you and if you would like to try and make that happen for you. Today's interview is with Kevin Perino, who is a writer and who wrote a book about the foreign policy of Abraham Lincoln. And Kevin's an example of someone for whom school encouraged, not discouraged. And it's a sweet story. And as you'll hear me say, I like to make this point whenever possible, because as often as school can discourage people, school teachers, in this case it was a principal, can encourage. And in Kevin's case, it set him on a road that is the road of his life. So I'll let Kevin tell the story and also talk about his book, which is fascinating. So here now is Kevin Perino. So I'm here with Kevin Perino, who has written Lincoln in the World, The Making of a Statesman, and The Dawn of American Power. I'm personally very interested in Lincoln. And so I was really looking forward to interviewing you. And I read I don't know what kind of a synopsis. No, it's not a synopsis. I don't know. They talked about what you're doing in the book because they didn't send me a book. Mm-hmm. However, I should tell you that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Mm.
And clearly, you are making some of your living, much of your life,
yeah,
with the art of writing.
Right.
Is that correct?
That's right.
Oh, okay, good. And I only ask one question, although at some point I'd like to talk about the book. The question I like to ask is, do you remember the very first moment in your life when it occurred to you that stories, writing, words, sounds were interesting, compelling, you liked them, you wanted to do them, you...
I do remember. I remember the exact moment, and it was in kindergarten.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went to Farmingville Elementary School, the public elementary school in Ridgefield, Connecticut, which was the town that I grew up in, and I had a great principal, Robert McDonald, at the time, and I had written an essay for my kindergarten, might have been first grade, and he read it, and he said, you know what? You can write. You're a good writer.
Wow.
You should think about doing some writing. And he, I think my parents came in for the teacher conference, and he said, you know what, Kevin's pretty good at writing. He should consider doing some more writing. And I did, and it was something that I continued to be, never really thought of doing anything else, continued to be a writer.
Well, wait. Mm. This is really interesting to me, and I like to highlight when this comes up the importance that teachers can have. They can say, they can do what they did for you, mm-hmm, and they can do the opposite. Mm. You know, they can encourage, they can set somebody on a path, mm, which is what happened for you. It's remarkable and wonderful. Mm. And they can make somebody, they can humiliate somebody and make sure they never try to do whatever that thing was again. Wow. So clearly, well, it seems clear that you remember that you remember him saying...
I think, you know, it happened a couple of times throughout my life, kind of my, as I was studying writing, where just what you said, where a teacher said, you know, you're good at this. And that's a really important thing. It happened again in college. I remember that Robert McClory, my writing professor in college, he sat me down and said, you know, you're good at writing. Have people told you that before? Like, you're good at this. And you remember, I mean, I remember the exact moment and the exact, and you know what, in a creative job like writing, which is difficult to, you know, it's difficult to get your stuff published, it's difficult, any job is difficult, but I think there's something about creative jobs that you really need the encouragement, you know, they don't always pay a lot at the beginning when you're trying to get established, and you need some perseverance, so you need people along the way saying, hey, you're good at this, you know, keep doing it,
yeah,
because otherwise, you know, you ask yourself, well, what am I doing? Why am I, you know, I'm doing, my friends are, you know, doing all these kinds of other things.
So, okay, we have you in kindergarten, and you're on the path, right? Already, you have some sense that this is something that you're going to get strokes for. It's not the word I wanted, but it'll have to do. And your parents also hear that this is something that you are good at, that you have a talent for.
Mm-hmm.
So do they encourage you? Do you know? I mean, do you begin to think about, do you write poems? Do you write in a journal? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, my parents were always very, very encouraging about it, and I think, I think they sort of subscribe to the school of thought that you're going to be successful at doing the thing that you do best, and that's really all I could do. You know, I wrote. I was a writer,
oh,
so I think, you know, I think they were very supportive.
Imagine having parents that think it's a good thing to encourage their son to be a writer.
Right.
You know, that's not that common.
Right, probably not.
No,
probably not.
Most parents are saying, all right, but what are you going to do for a living?
Right,
you know.
Do your writing, you know,
when
your law job is over.
Exactly,
or whatever,
exactly.
You know,
so good for them.
Yeah.
Good for all of these people who were there to, you know, put the wind behind your sails kind of thing.
Right.
But you must have wanted it. You must have loved it, or, I mean, because people can say you're good at it, you know, until they're blue in the face, but if it isn't something inside of you, then would you do it? So do you remember liking it? Being drawn to it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, as I said, I've never really considered doing anything else because it's, you know, you kind of, I think anybody, when they're doing something that they love, you feel like a fish in water, you know, this is what you do. And writing is always what I've done. I mean, I started as a journalist, so I'm writing history now. My book is about Abraham Lincoln's foreign policy, Lincoln in the World, but I started my career as a journalist and a foreign correspondent. So I came to writing historical narratives in a kind of backward way. Phil Graham, the old head of the Washington Post, was the parent company of the company that I was working for, said, you know, journalism is the first draft of history. And so so I came at it from doing journalism. But yeah, they're very similar kind of skills, and you're gathering information and evaluating it and then crafting it into a narrative. And so whether it's journalism or historical writing, that's really the only thing I've done. That's
I got it. And I love that image that when you're doing it, it's like a fish in water. I've never heard anybody say that, and I do know what that feels like, and I think that's correct, that you have a sense that you are in the place you're supposed to be in.
Right,
this is where you belong or fit or is natural to you.
Right.
It's your natural environment, right? I really love that.
Right. I think there's something to the fact that, you know, we're most successful in the world at the things that we do best when we do feel like that as a fish in water. So.
I agree. Right. Although I don't think it works for everybody.
Right.
But I think
Everybody's got a different pool of water, right? Different people are good at different things. So somebody else might feel like a fish in water as, you know, doing debentures, you know, or whatever. I don't know. But for me it's writing.
Okay. All right. So, you started your career as a journalist. That was very smart because as a writer, that's one of the few ways in which you can get paid right away. Mm. And apparently you got work, so, okay. So, is this your first book?
It's my first one that I've done on my own. I've done one with a team of other people. We did a book about the 2004 campaign every year. I worked at Newsweek for many years, and so we did a... every year they would detach reporters, every election cycle, detach reporters to cover the campaign, and then you would publish a book afterwards. You would kind of mush the reporting together and craft it into a narrative. And so I did that. But this is my first solo
venture. Yes. Yeah. Well, this is a big deal. So why did you choose this?
Well, I started it when I was a foreign correspondent. I was reporting on the ground from places like Syria and Yemen and Libya, kind of doing foreign affairs reporting from the street level. And I went through this period where I kind of felt myself wanting to step back and look at kind of larger frameworks of American foreign policy and started researching these. And this period just kind of sucked me in because the characters are amazing. You've got Lincoln's minister to Russia is this guy, Cassius Marcellus Clay, walks around the streets of St. Petersburg with Bowie knives dangling from his waistband and getting in fist fights on the streets of St. Petersburg. Lincoln's his minister to Paris ends up dying in the apartment of what Carl Sandburg, Lincoln biographer, called a woman not his wife, and his body has to be smuggled back to the embassy. So you just had these, you know, characters that were straight out of a novel, except I happened to write nonfiction, and so that's how I came to it. And you know, one of the reasons I think there hasn't been a book about this, about Lincoln's foreign policy. I mean, there's 15,000 books about Lincoln, right? But
right.
So the first question I get from people are, what are you thinking? You know, why? What are you
another book
have?
About Lincoln?
Right. But
after Doris's, by the way.
Right, exactly. After, did you not see the movie? But, you know, but,
right.
But this has been a topic. Foreign affairs and Lincoln is something that just hasn't been done in 70 years, which is before the Lincoln Papers were even available. I mean, so there's a lot of water under the bridge since then. And part of the reason is that Lincoln had a strong and competent Secretary of State, so he delegated a lot. So if you put Lincoln right in the middle of his own foreign policy, you get a hagiography. So what I've
wait. So his Secretary of State was...
Seward.
Seward, right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, he has his flaws. He can be a vain and a volatile person.
The
story I like about Seward is he would sometimes tip his cap on the street to people that he thought might recognize him. That tells you a little something about who he was.
Well, and he wanted to be president.
And he wanted to be president, right. In the 1860 election, and a lot of people thought he should have been.
Yeah,
so did he. he did too, and he was resentful about that. But the thing that he was is very well-traveled, and he was a competent chief diplomat for the most part. Lincoln overruled him on one or two things, but they ended up working very well together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, what's important, I think, is the way you slice it. There's a great Lincoln biographer, James Randall, who said, Lincoln didn't do as much as Teddy Roosevelt or Franklin Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson in foreign affairs, but the things that he did do are really important. So what I've tried to do is look at the things that he did do in foreign affairs without saying he did everything.
Right.
Or without saying he did everything right. I mean, he wasn't perfect. He made some mistakes also.
Well, I read Dawes's book, and I mean, this isn't foreign affairs, but I'm surprised we won the war, given,
Now we're in Florida. When you say we won the war, who are we talking about?
Well, I'm a New Yorker.
Okay, because you have to ask around here sometimes.
Right. Well, I'm surprised that the North won the war, mm-hmm. given he made horrendous mistakes in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious. Well, I'm curious about a lot of things. I want to hear the mistakes that you think he made.
Mm-hmm.
What I read suggests that you're talking about the ways in which what he did set up the United States to be what we used to be, because I don't think we are anymore. Mm-hmm. But in what I read, I'm not sure it's accurate, you talk about use some of what's going on today and look back and, right?
Sure,
So do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think I'll start with mistakes. That's the first thing that you asked about. One of his biggest kind of turkeys was colonization. Lincoln favored sending free black Americans to Central America or Africa as part of the Emancipation Proclamation and afterwards. This is obviously a mistake in hindsight. There are serious moral and practical problems with doing this. Some people said that at the time. Seward was telling him, Seward liked to say, I'm always in favor of bringing people into this country, never sending them out of it. And so some people, that was one occasion where Seward...
Maybe this isn't correct, but I was under the impression that the fact that he took that position helped... There were a lot of people who held that position, and that was something, he didn't, obviously, in the end, he didn't do it. We didn't do it, it wasn't done.
He tried, but Congress didn't do it.
I didn't realize that he tried.
He tried several times kind of getting support for this from various constituencies, and it just never really... I mean, this is... He's in a long line of people who... This isn't something that Lincoln invented. Clay was,
right.
A movement
for
colonization. But you're right. He saw it partly as a way of...
Gaining support
among border state slaveholders who would be alienated by abolition or by
emancipation. Right, exactly. That was what I thought.
But it's a very kind of complicated historiographical debate. It's very complicated. I mean, there are people who there's a very hot debate among academics right now about colonization. There are some people who say just this, that they call it the lullaby thesis, that he was basically trying to we're doing abolition, but we're going to give you this lullaby of colonization. And there's other people, some more recent scholarship, that suggested that Lincoln really genuinely believed in colonization, not because he was a racist, but because he thought that it was one solution to a very difficult problem. But he genuinely, thing that he held to the end of his life. So the debate goes on.
I didn't know. Okay, good. All right, so that's a mistake. Sort of.
Yeah. Another one is, I think people don't realize this, but or we forget it, that the French invaded Mexico in the middle of the Civil War. I mean, while this war is raging north of the Rio Grande, Napoleon III, the French emperor, sends his troops into Mexico, and they conquer Mexico City in 1863. He installs his puppet in 1864. And so in the middle of this war, Lincoln has this major challenge to the Monroe Doctrine. And I think Lincoln's handling of this ultimately was excellent, one mistake he made early on is in the sort of the fall of 1863, he pushed his generals very hard to send troops to the Texas-Mexico border to essentially to send a message to Napoleon.
Back off, right.
It was a mistake, though, because he could have used those troops to win
the war.
Some battles closer to home, you know. It was a small mistake, but in the long run, Lincoln basically realized that Napoleon would undo himself in Mexico. He was overextended. There were a lot of problems in Europe at the time, and so he basically had a kind of okay, well, you know, let's let this happen. And there were people urging Lincoln to invade Mexico. There were people urging the Union and Confederate armies, and not just crackpots, but people close to Lincoln saying we should unite the two armies, march into Mexico, and kick Napoleon in and out, and it will be something that would unite North and South, and it was a serious-ish proposal, and Lincoln said no, it's not, you know, that's not going to do us any good. He was right about that.
Great. Okay, so those are the mistakes.
So those are a few of the mistakes.
Yeah. Oh, you want to tell some more? I don't mind.
No,
I like it.
Yeah, those are the big ones.
So. Okay, all right. So what are the things that he did that we're seeing ramifications of today even?
Well, Lincoln had an excellent, I think, broad picture view of the nature of American power. Lincoln was a Whig, member of the Whig Party, mm-hmm. before he was a Republican, and the Whigs essentially believed that the path to power, to world power, would be economic growth, and that wars of conquest would not necessarily do anything, foreign wars of conquest, to enhance American power in the long run. And so Lincoln opposed the Mexican War in 1846, the origins of the Mexican War, I should say. He opposed some of these kind of interventions early on and kind of favored, but he was a strong, it's not the same as saying he's an isolationist. People didn't use that word isolationist in the mid-19th century. That's a 20th century word. He believed in economic expansion, economic ties, trade ties. The Whig Party was looking at Asian export markets, you know, 150 years before, you know, Secretary of State Clinton, Secretary of State Kerry, and the pivot to Asia and all this kind of stuff. So
really?
I think his nature, his notion of what it meant to be a powerful country was kind of genuinely sound thing. And then on top of that, it impressed me that Lincoln was able to do what he was able to do with the tools that he had. I mean, the diplomatic corps in the mid-19th century was pretty ridiculous. I mean, it was seen as kind of a dumping ground for political enemies and radicals, abolitionists. They sometimes sent him overseas to get him out of the way. And one story that I like from the book is a group of men come to Lincoln in the White House and trying to get their guy appointed as a diplomat in the Sandwich Islands, which is Hawaii now. And they make their case on the merit, and they kind of, you know, push for their guy. And then they say, and you know, he's really sick. He's not doing too good. The climate in Hawaii would really do him good. And Lincoln has this great line. He says, you know, gentlemen, I have 8 other applicants for that job, and they're all sicker than your man. And, you know, sends them on his way. But the irony is actually, Lincoln tried that himself, or Lincoln's friends did, in the early 1840s, when Lincoln went through bouts of depression when he was a young man. His allies made just this case, using this kind of same argument, to Daniel Webster, the Secretary of State at the time in 1841, and said, you know, Lincoln is, he's not doing too good. You should appoint him to
something.
Columbia. Yeah, it would do him good. Change of scenery would be good for him. And Daniel Webster says, you know, I don't think so. And he didn't get the job. So it was a different time in diplomacy.
Were you captured by Lincoln? Or is it the, I don't know, I mean, is it the man, or is it the circumstance, the condition, the... Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I certainly admire him. There is something, you're right, about his story, I think, that has the power to capture people. And I think a lot of it is in the emotional highs and lows of the end of the war. I mean, you have this thing, you have this you know, unbelievable war, and this, you know, this kind of soaring elation in the of the victory, and then this, you know, unbelievable low in Lincoln's assassination. I think that kind of emotional roller coaster has really the power to enchant people, and has been for the last 150 years. And you notice, I notice it. I did a lot of the research at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, and somebody told me, I don't know if this is true or not, that the Disney engineers helped to kind of, you know, plan the way it was, but it's a really powerful thing. You walk through Lincoln's life, and at that end, you know, no matter what, how many biographies of Lincoln have I read, you know, and dozens of them, and it's something about those last months of the war that have an incredible power to get people's attention. And I think the other thing is that I think people find Lincoln a hopeful figure because of what he had to endure in his own life. There's that thing, you may have seen it somewhere, it's floating around on the internet, and I think there's kind of inspirational posters made of it, like, I think it's called Lincoln's Failures, and
it has
the things that, you know, all the things that he failed at. And so I think, you know, you can look at Lincoln and say, well, if this guy did it, if this guy, you know, this guy is one of the greatest presidents of all time, probably the greatest American president, and this is what he had to deal with it, there's hope for me, you know, with my insomnia or my whatever, you know,
whatever
problems that we have in our ordinary life. So I think there's something about that that's inspiring.
I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that's true. Also, he has at least the patina of someone who had honor, was committed to what he believed in, and stood by it.
Right. Yeah, there's something to that, the honest Abe trope, and there's truth to it. He wasn't always honest. His law partner said, you know, he's the most shut-mouthed man I've ever met, so he could be wily, too, but you're right. I think we recognize that he basically had good judgment, he made good decisions, and he was the kind of guy we'd like to have for dinner, you know?
Well, whether he did or not,
right,
that's the sense that one is left with.
Right.
So, what was it like for you writing this? Did you like the work?
I loved it. I mean, there's nothing quite like being able to dig into a subject. You know, I come at this from journalism, where you have a deadline, you know, every week or every day sometimes, you know, with web stories. And so, it's really a satisfying thing to be able to take a few years and really sink your teeth into something like this. So, you know, there's several parts to it. There's the kind of background reading, you know, you kind of read the everything that you
everything.
Can get your hand on.
Right.
Not everything, I'm not going to lie. I mean, there's 15,000 books about them. I didn't read all 15,000, but you read what you can, in and then you kind of dig into the archival stuff, which is in the mostly in the U.S., some in Europe. One of the interesting things about this is, you know, to get back to this question of, you know, well, what could you possibly turn up that's new about Lincoln? But there's one of the things about Lincoln biographies is there's been this genuine and kind of surprising boom in Lincoln scholarship in recent years. But I don't just mean the number of biographies, I mean the quality of the stuff. And the reason is, one of the techniques that modern Lincoln biographers use is some of these biographers that have written about him historically have become figures of importance in their own right, and so they leave their papers, their note cards essentially, for their own biographies to the Library of Congress or university libraries. Scholars can then go back to them and find things in their note cards that have ended up on the cutting room floor, and you have to check it, of course, it's somebody else's notes, but it's useful stuff, and it adds a lot of texture. The great at this is Michael Burlingame, who, if you want to read a great Lincoln biography, his is a two-volume, it's a massive thing, it's kind of the gold standard now, and he did just this. He kind of went to these papers of past historians and biographers and pulled things out, and that was a really useful technique in my book about Lincoln's foreign policy, because you could look at things through the lens of foreign policy that, you know, Carl Sandburg or James Randall or some of these other great Lincoln biographers didn't want to see.
It out.
Right. And so that was something I did. And one of the things that came up in that process is Mary Lincoln. One of the sets of papers I went to are a biographer of Mary Lincoln. And when you look at her papers, you sometimes, you know, you find some of these kind of these instances where she interfered in diplomatic appointments because in many ways she was more cosmopolitan than Lincoln. She had grown up in this, you know, in Lexington, the Athens of the West, and spoke French growing up in a boarding school. And she and her family, the Todds, kind of lorded this over Lincoln. Lincoln liked to say that 1D was good enough for God, but not for the Todds. And so, so she played a role too, and that's something that I think comes out when you really, you know, take a close look at some of the papers that
are. So you love this. This is like a scavenger hunt for you.
It is like a scavenger hunt. Yeah, yeah. And you're trying to dig in. In a way, it's not all that different from reporting. You're trying to go kind of dig out new pieces of information, evaluate the reporting, and then craft it.
Yeah, but what's interesting to me about that is that's what you like.
Right.
You like this part of writing.
Right.
You know, the research part.
Right. Like I would be a useless novelist because
but
I don't have the
imagination.
Yeah, I mean it's an entirely an act of imagination. I mean you have to do reporting to write a novel too, I understand, but
no, but that's not
it's
what
a different
captured
thing.
You.
Right.
You like this.
Yeah, you're right. I like the hunt of it.
You like the hunt of it. Yeah, it's great. And I can see it when you talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, you light up.
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
great. Okay, so I like to ask, given that you've given quite a number of years here of your life to the work of writing in one way or another, is there anything that you would say about what that's like?
Well, I mean, honestly, I've just loved every minute of it. I mean, I've treated it as a job, as I think you have to. I think Graham Greene, the novelist, once said, you know, there's no talent. There's just work, and you have to, you know, you have to. He used to write 600 or 800. Or he used to, you know, promise to himself that he would write 600 or 800 words a day, and that was his limit. And he would go to his desk and sit down and write it. And Robert Caro, the great biographer of Lyndon Johnson, he would, you know, worked in his home, and he would go, and he would every day put on a jacket and a tie and sit there, and, you know, he's in his home because that's his work. Now he's in work mode. So I admire those writers who think of their job as a job, and it's something to, you know, obviously it's not exactly like any other job where you go and you punch in, but I think to be productive at it, you also have to treat it like a job and go and, you know, kick out your word count, or if not your word count, at least, you know, go and be disciplined about doing your work every day, or it's not going to get done. So
do you do that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, when I'm writing, I mean, a lot of times I'll have a word count in mind. Doesn't mean I always doesn't always mean I always make it, and doesn't, you know, doesn't often look like Graham Greene's does at the end of 800 words, but you know, I do what I can. So.
Yeah, I don't think that's right about the talent and just work. But
well, he was probably being modest also. I think it's a combination of both. But I think his point is a useful correction to this notion that only a creative genius can be a writer. I think, you know, I think.
So you don't think that that there's something in the person that draws them to writing as opposed to not drawing them to writing?
No, I agree with that completely. I'm just saying, you know, there's this kind of notion out there that writers are, there's this kind of romantic thing, writers are these kind of reclusive, self-destructive figures, and,
I see.
You know, that honestly, if you're reclusive and self-destructive, you don't get a whole lot done. I don't think it's a particularly useful image. So, you know, some are like that, and creative people can be like that sometimes, but I think, you know, at the end of the day, the writers who are actually producing books are disciplined about getting their work done also.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because I didn't realize that what you were doing was responding to that myth. I don't know. I think people who love to write write because they love to write. That doesn't mean that they aren't disciplined and they don't work hard.
Right.
But what's driving them, in my experience, is internal.
Right.
Do you know that?
Right. I've heard people say that before. That
does it not feel like
the book that you have to write is the one that feels like you can't not write it. Well, you know, it's just got to come out.
It's when you're writing that you're not thinking, this is word 602,
right.
Or you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. I do know what you're saying, and I'm overstating a little bit to make a point.
I know you are.
But you can't, you can't always think of that like it, like, you know, it's not like any other job where, you know, your statistic is the measure of how well you've done that day. But
right.
But I think it's useful sometimes.
It's all right. It's okay. You can have it. We won't let anybody, anybody who's listening to this anyway, believe that writers are ne'er-do-well people who are always drunk or, you know, not working or whatever.
Right.
But when I'm listening to you talking about the process of writing, I suspect that what's driving you is what it feels like to do it.
Yeah.
And not some kind of arbitrary idea of discipline.
Right. Well, it's both. It has to be both. Because there are some days when no matter
how much you love writing, you would rather watch
a football game, or you would rather, you know, go to a party or whatever, you know, so it's both.
I think that's right. I think it is both. And so just to be as clear as possible, if you had to say something about what giving a life to writing is for you, what would you say?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I think I've said it. It's just a real pleasure to be able to do something that you love every day. And it's not, you know, I don't think everybody has a job that they love every single day. And I can say most of the time when I'm doing writing, whether it's, you know, reporting and writing or historical writing, doesn't feel like work. And I think, I don't want you to say that out loud, because then nobody will pay me to do it anymore. If I say it's that I would do it for free, you know.
It's okay. So I won't tell.
Okay.
It's a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Okay, thanks for having me on. This was fun.
Okay, so we have to keep Kevin's secret, and not tell the world that it isn't work when he's writing. Of course, this is the point of the show that I do, right? That one's life doesn't feel like work. It feels right. It feels comfortable. It feels like me. It feels like what I should be doing. And not just in the area of one's life, but of course it's desirable, mostly desirable, for the area of one's life to also be a place that doesn't feel like work. That the area of work doesn't feel like work. And as Kevin said, and as pretty much everybody that I interview says, most people don't have the luxury of feeling that the work that they do doesn't feel like work. If you've been listening and you've listened to the writers and the actors and the directors and the fine artists and the dancers, they all say the same thing. When I'm doing this, it doesn't feel like work. So, of course, the point of the Lynn Show is that when one is living one's life, it feels what the therapists would say, congruent. I am in sync with my life. I am doing what it is natural for me to do. when I say what is meant for me to do, I don't mean this in a metaphysical sense, although maybe that's also true. But what I mean is that I'm not at odds with myself. I'm not fighting myself. I'm not saying, God, how I hate this, or God, how I would like to be able to be doing something else. And my reference to God here is not not religious. But you know what I mean, that you wake up in the morning and you think, oy, oy, that's not a religious statement either. I don't want to go here. I don't want to do this. I want to be doing something else. Or when the depression about the distress that comes from living a life that doesn't feel like yours, I don't want to do anything. And that, it seems to me, is the real challenge of our lives. As I said in the beginning, and I say in all the shows, I believe that this happens because something in our childhood tells us that something about ourselves is not okay. We believe it absolutely, and we begin very, very young to try and pretend that this thing about us doesn't exist. We understand the consequences of being something that is unacceptable to our family of origin, in our school, to our religion, to our culture. We understand that the consequence of that is to be isolated, to be abandoned, to be alone. And certainly as young children, that means essentially to die. So this is not small or frivolous. This is life saving. This is the creation of a coping mechanism that allows us to function within the organization or the system that doesn't like something about us. In my book, I say that what this leads to is the creation of a cover story. Like the spy, the cover story is designed to protect us from exposure. It's a myth that we present so that others don't know that there is something about us that would endanger us. The difference between the spy and the rest of us is that spies know that what they're presenting is a fiction. We do not. By the time we come out of childhood, we have so convinced ourselves that this thing, which didn't work, which didn't go down well, which was unacceptable, doesn't exist. So we are in denial for pieces of ourselves. The problem here is that while denial works perfectly well to help us demonstrate a person that doesn't have this thing, it doesn't allow us to completely forget that we have it. It doesn't amputate it or exercise it. That thing, whatever we had to pretend isn't there, is still there. And we know it. And it is what leads to the feeling of I'm a fraud, if only I could, if they knew me better, they wouldn't like me, and all those things. And also, it is what leads to sadness, to the feeling of I am somehow inadequate or flawed, to the yearning to be someone other than I am, to the sadness about having not achieved, and I don't mean this in terms of success, I mean simply achieved myself, been myself. So of course you know that I believe that listening to these shows is a way that you can stimulate the part of you which got denied. And when it is stimulated, it doesn't always feel so good. It feels awkward, difficult, sometimes anxiety-producing. But it is also the beginning of the recovering of ourselves. And as I also said in the beginning, that is the purpose of therapy. And if you are interested in talking about the process of therapy or the recovery of pieces left behind, please do go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, and talk to me. So, as always, I hope you got something that you could use from this show. You learned something about Lincoln that you didn't know and is interesting to you. You got to hear what it sounds like when early in life somebody says, yeah, you're really good at that, hey. And you get to follow that trajectory into a happy life that doesn't feel like work. Maybe you just got to laugh, as I did. In any case, I hope you heard something that'll bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't